Contained herein are the heresies of Radolf Burntwine, erstwhile monk-turned-traveling medical investigator. Join me as I uncover the blasphemous truth of a plague-ridden world, that ours is not a loving God, and we are not its favored children. The Heresies of Radolf Burntwine, coming January 2nd, wherever podcasts are available.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of IGN Unfiltered, my regularly occurring interview series where I have the privilege of sitting down with the best, brightest, most interesting minds in the gaming industry. Today, my guest is Hakan Abrek. He is the CEO and co-owner of IO Interactive. They are fresh off of a big hit in Hitman 3, one of 2021's biggest games already. Hakan, welcome.
Hey, how are you doing? Thank you so much for having me here.
It is a pleasure. As I started to research you and sort of learn more about you, you've had a wonderful career story, pretty much at IO. But before I kind of get to that, I actually wanted to start. I could not find this on the internet, and maybe everybody listening is going to think this is dumb. Maybe this is widespread knowledge that I just don't have. But what does the studio name mean? What is IO? I couldn't find it. There's a bird that's spelled IO, but pronounced EO, and then there's like input output. So is there a story there?
Well, I mean, there are a lot of myths about what it is. I've been with IO for more than 14 years now, but I'm not a part of the founders. And when you ask them, still know most of them, right? And when I ask them, it's like, they don't even remember themselves why or what it was. Input output is a good guess. Another one is planets, IO, and right. Stuff like that. So they're having fun with being a bit secretive around that. Honestly, I don't. There's not a clear like this is it. So
Well, I guess that's kind of IGN's the same way. So some people, it used to be like Imagine Games Network way back in the day because that was the old parent company. So I can relate to that. Maybe someday you guys will make like a little anniversary video and tell us all, the founders will tell us all what it really means.
And we'll get together with the founders and we'll figure it out over some good Danish beer.
Sounds good. Yeah, when all this is over, which we've got the light at the end of the tunnel here. So I'll take you up on that. Now, you specifically, you mentioned you've been there a long time. So you joined IO in 2006. And what I think is really interesting about you, you didn't just come in as the CEO of the studio. You've held a number of roles in that time. You were the tech department producer. You were a multiplayer producer on Kane & Lynch 2, executive producer on Hitman Absolution, executive producer of the R&D department, studio production director, head of studio, and now CEO and co-owner. You've really worked your way up, which I respect the hell out of. I mean, you're not just a suit in a boardroom with a silver spoon in your mouth making, major decisions for hundreds of employees. I mean, you are making those decisions, but you're doing it coming from a place of having worked alongside them. You've gotten your hands dirty. So to you, how important has that perspective been for you as you have now assumed the role of studio leadership?
I think it's a very, very important part, point. And I think, whatever, as you said, starting from as a tech producer and looking at the things that you have to do as a CEO in terms of, the business side of things, I think it gives you, more credibility. As you said, it's not only a person in a suit, but I've done my time in production over the years. So I think it gives a bit more credibility, both for talking to business partners. But I think the greatest benefit of this, I would say, is that I have a great relationship to people in the studio. And I think when you ask for some extraordinary things, when you ask people to do something above and beyond, it does help that you tried that yourself on your own body, right? That you have some of those battle scars and you know what it means, you know, well, we can push a bit more here, or like, you know, this thing is not good for the team. You know, let's be mindful about this and that. So I think I have, because I've been there myself, I have a really good feeling for both, you know, the art of developing games and also the credibility of being a game developer when we talk to partners.
So the studio itself has been on a hell of a ride over the years, which you've been there for most of that. It's a number of transformations, and you know, so the studio has been very successful since spinning off into its own independence some years back. I'm curious, since you guys parted ways with Square Enix, have any other publishers called you since you guys became a, you know, free agent, as it were, to try and acquire you? Because you guys went out on your own with Hitman and proved it all over again. So I got to wonder if any of the other big boys knocked on your door.
Sure. I mean, you know, IO has 20 years plus history of making games and making high quality games. And we also created 4 original IPs from ground up. So with that reputation, of course, there were other companies and publishers and whatnot contacting us. And, you know, to be completely frank and honest, there were times where, you know, just to put things in perspective, I think I mentioned that before in different interviews, but when we went independent, we literally had 3 months of cash flow before we had to kind of, close shop, right? And so there were times where it was close in some scenarios where we'd be like, okay, we have to find an investor, or we have to kind of go with this. But we really, you know, the vision we had, you know, taking the risk with doing an MBO, the vision we had for Hitman 2016, we knew that we built a platform where it wasn't just about, you know, the performance, sell performance the first 3 months or 6 months. We knew we were in for a marathon. We built this platform where we could have this long lasting relationship with our fans and build a community. And it wasn't like in the old days where you're used to with Hitman, like the first 6 months, it would be like 80% of lifetime sales kind of thing, right? So it was a slow starter that way. But the different instances we had, like the live elements that we have planned, we believe that those would be impactful. And it just, the team and the management, we believed the initiatives would be impactful. And we kept being a bit resilient with these, some of the offers were really, really attractive, right? And it would have been easy in many ways. But I think at that point we were like, you know, we really need to owe IO to try to do this ourselves. And, you know, the initiatives not only did work, it just went above and beyond all our expectations. So we lived another day and another day and another year, and then, you know, went from strength to strength today, which, you know, it's absolutely amazing.
You know, it's pretty rare that a major publisher that had acquired you years before, in this case, Eidos, which became Square Enix, would let you walk away, and especially while keeping your arguably most valuable intellectual property to boot in the form of Hitman. So I'm just curious, this is what this show is all about. I love kind of seeing the inner works of things. Were you in the room for those discussions with Square of how the separation was going to occur? And what was that period of the company's histories like from the inside?
Well, I mean, every day was a new adventure, right? Like every day was, we didn't know what's going to happen. And I was very much in those talks and discussions. You know, the plan was, there were several plans. One of them was to divest IO. I think the MBO wasn't really the first kind of option that came to mind. Quickly we felt like that it meant something what the studio management wanted, like what the management from IO wanted, right? Like it's there are almost 200 people. There's a lot of running cost for a company like that. So anyone who would consider to buy IO would obviously would need to be convinced by what I and the rest of the studio management wanted to do, right? And so quickly it became a third party discussions, right, with whoever different parties who came in and discussed things. And, you know, to the point I said before, we were really, you know, there are different models that were discussed about, you know, turning IO into a different kind of company, which maybe would have worked, maybe wouldn't, but it wasn't like what we were burning for. It wasn't like what we were like envisioning for IO's future. And so, you know, there were points where I was like, okay, if it's going to save people's jobs, I'm okay at doing this and just walking away. If I believed that it would have been a good thing for IO, if I believed that it would have been something that would you know, both be true to our history, but also put IO in a position where it could keep being this powerhouse of creating new worlds, new characters, new IPs. And I wasn't all that convinced with a lot of these different discussions back then. And, you know, slowly we were talking about whether there's another way, right? I mean, Square Enix, as you said, it's a bit of an unusual situation, but Square Enix back then they were heavily investing in Marvel deal they made. Now, obviously, Avengers came out meanwhile, and also, you know, between the Montreal studio and the San Francisco studio, so they had a lot of investments going on. And as we talked about with the episodic model on Hitman 2016, it was a disappointing start. Like commercially, it was really, really bad. So you know, I could understand that they were looking at, you know, they also don't have unlimited money, obviously, and they were looking at, okay, how can we go on in the West with the investments in the States and Montreal, and how can we maybe like look for opportunities with IO Interactive? So I've said that many times. I have absolutely no bad feelings with Square Enix. Actually, they've been amazing and in this whole process, and very like transparent and direct. You know, honest. So we were presenting different models where we say, okay, like, what if this is what we believe in, right? This is the model where IO, like, we'll take responsibility if IO goes down, like the bankrupt, it will be on us. And, you know, we believe the best path forward is, you know, what we presented to Square Enix, right? And, you know, they got a small, you know, minority share with them. Right, so which, you know, back then was a gamble for them, you could say, but today it you know, looking back, it was maybe a good choice. It seems like it's paying off for them as well. So so that's how it ended. And actually, like, it every day there was new discussions and new opportunities and new allies that avenues that this could turn. But at the end, we got Square Enix convinced. And this would be the right thing for IO Interactive, and then we went for it.
Well, I have a couple follow-ups here, because this is super interesting to me. Like, number one, how did you convince them to let you keep Hitman? Because I, you know, that is arguably the most attractive and valuable thing that IO has built thus far, and it's most major, you know, big fish, big shark publishers are not. They don't usually let IP walk away with a studio that they're parting ways with like that. Usually they hang on to those IPs. So is there sort of what's, can you talk a little bit more about how Hitman got retained specifically? Because it's fascinating to me.
Well, I think there's a number of reasons that was discussed before, and I can only guess what they were thinking. But, you know, I was definitely arguing for why Hitman and IO is, you know, pretty much synonymous with each other. And, you know, they were obviously also in the know in what we built with Hitman. So it was not only a game, The episodic release was only the start of something that would evolve over time. I mean, the main thing wasn't the episodic, really. It was that it was an ever-expanding universe they were creating. So Hitman 2 and 3, the trilogy, is actually a connected universe, right? So if you buy Hitman 3, you can have Hitman 1 and 2 in it, like in the menus, like starts from Paris and to the last location, Hitman 3. So they knew that if IO was to, you know, the vision that we were betting on, and if IO was to succeed, you know, and their again their lottery ticket, if that was to have a chance to increase in value, then, you know, probably would be with Hitman and the platform we built. That's one thing. And I think the other thing is, again, back to Hitman being synonymous with IO, I think, like, one of the things that we are very, very proud of, and I think it's one of the core competences of IO as a studio, is the way we make, like, our simulations in our locations, the level design, the AI, and all these working together in an immensely complex way. And I think
it's always been special.
Exactly. And I think also, you know, the idea of just taking Hitman and as an IP and say, well, we're just going to give it to another studio, I don't think that's I don't think that's easy. So the talent, it's not only the IP. The IP is extremely valuable. And I think today it's even more valuable after the last 4 or 5 years now. But I think the people who made Hitman and who knows Hitman are equally, if not more, valuable.
And then you also mentioned one thing I wanted to follow up on. You know, in those discussions where, you know, what was going to happen with IO and the separation from Square and possibly having to fold in and, you know, maybe be bought by another company. It sounds like, am I sort of interpreting you correctly, that it sounds like maybe somebody else would have wanted to pick you up as a, and just sort of turn IO into a support studio? Is that, am I sort of interpreting that correctly? Because you're talking about sort of changing the nature of the studio in a way that you didn't feel was going to be the best.
Well, I have a lot of opinions about support studios. I hope we can talk about that a bit later. But I think maybe some of them were thinking that IO, you know, talent developers, they could be a support studio. But I mean, there were various different partners that discussed various different models with, and they all had, you know, their approach to what IO should be or look like moving forward. And I'm sure some of them would have worked, but as I mentioned before, it wasn't like what we were burning for, what we believed in. You know, it's not only like a support studio, but it could be, if you imagine, like, let's just say that, if you let go half of IO and hire analysts instead and optimize the content, and, you know, can we make Hitman free to play or things like that, right? Like, which, you know, I think free to play is very interesting. It's very, I think there's some really, really, really cool experiences that are fit for that. But the Hitman we made in 2016 is not one of them. So we wouldn't feel right to go with a model for that and turn Hitman 2016 back then into a free to play kind of model. So and there were also other, you know, ambition was also a thing. IO, can you be less ambitious, or can you be somebody else than you are? And while IO has always been adapting or trying different things, from middle-aged criminals to mini ninjas for kids, and freedom fighters and whatnot, we are not afraid of trying different things, and we are very agile and adaptable. But when that is said, if it's something that our hearts are not beating for or pounding, you know, and we don't believe in that direction, then passion and belief is a big thing for us, and mechanical work is just simply not going to work for us.
You know, you mentioned a minute ago that you hoped we'd talk more about support studios later, so let's do it, because I'm kind of curious what you clearly have opinions on this. I mean, to me, as somebody who plays a ton of games and covers games for a living, it really seems like support studios are, that term might almost be even unfair. It's almost like you need those co-development partners more than ever now as games get bigger and more ambitious. So yeah, how do you feel about co-development, about support studios, about partners and trying to bring your visions to life?
Well, I think it's a huge strength to work with extended teams. We've done that before. We work with Sumo, and we work with companies in Netherlands and in Austria for many, many years, and we have fantastic relationship to them. Back in the days, we were outsourcing a lot to China, just over the fence outsourcing. But for many, many years, we've kind of treated and built our partners as extended teams, got them very proficient with our own engine and whatnot. So I think the flexibility, and it's not something about, like, it's not because of price or saving money. It's really about flexibility. When you need that help, the timing of that is very important. And I would rather have talented people that we respect and that we see as our equals than trying to save money. That has been our mentality all the time. But when I said about support studios, it's because when we went independent, it was, as I said, we only had 3 months of cash flow. It was pretty tough things in front of us, pretty tough decisions we had to make. We were 174 people at that time, almost half of the team we had to let go to survive another day. Today, we are more than 200 people. So we've grown over the last four years, and that growth is going to be more exponential moving forward. The way I wanted to grow, I changed my thinking around how to grow studios or the team, because I've been with IO back in the days where I was a producer of one of the projects, and we had like four AAA projects, two engines, three actually, under the same roof, and we were like over almost 400 people in one building, and there's something about the culture there. When you have these different projects and you're that many people on the same roof, you create these different subcultures. You create this in some cases I would say a bit almost like animosity, like unhealthy competition under the same roof, right? So which was a bit of a shame. So I was thinking, like, how can we do that differently? We're going to grow. It's going really well, right? We're doing well. We're going to grow. We have these opportunities. Let's go for it. So how are we going to do that? And there's something called the Dunbar number. There's something like around 140, 150 people. Like, also, I read a book called Sabians by Havari. I really recommend that book. It's amazing. He also talks about how we build relations and what is the capacity of having, like, putting a face on people and feeling like this is a place where I belong and it still feels familiar and doesn't turn into this factory kind of factor that we talked about, right? So the building we live in Copenhagen, our studio, can easily have 300 plus people, but we are around 150 in Copenhagen. And we have opened a new studio in Malmö. In Sweden, is very close by, just on the other side of the bridge. It's another country, but we are neighbor country, so it's very close. But the reason for doing that is because I don't want to be more than 150 people in one building. Now, IO can be 300, 400, 500 plus people, and millions of people can collaborate over all over the globe. But there's something about the efficiency and something about feeling like belonging that you lose if you go above that. So Malmö is the same thing. Like, it's we are almost 50 people there, and we're going to keep growing there. And who knows? Maybe one point soon we'll announce a third location. So what I like to say is we're one studio in different locations. And what I mean with that, sorry, there's a lot of talk to get to the support studio part. But no, what I mean with that is like, we have. We have 007 that we work on. We have Hitman that we're working on. And maybe we can talk about, we're just going to mention we're working on something else as well, something third, something completely new, a new IP. And Hitman 3, the game director was working from Malmö, and the executive producer was working from Copenhagen. And it's kind of zigzag. You know, you could have a lead working from Malmö and another lead, another domain working from Copenhagen. The point I'm trying to make is that what's important in I.O. is our projects. And everybody should feel first-grade citizens if you're a part of I.O. And it doesn't matter if you're in Malmö, it doesn't matter if you're in Copenhagen, and it doesn't matter if you're in, you know, whatever, Netherlands or Austria or whatever you are. If you're working, if you're Ionian or working on one of our projects, you could have a very impactful role. And there's nothing about like a support studio mentality. Everybody's working on the projects on equal terms. And I think, you know, both with the avoiding the factory kind of mentality, having this overarching values culture we have, but also giving space for having these local values under that umbrella value, and having that like opportunity to be working as, you know, impactful roles on whatever project we have, regardless of where you are in the world. I think those things are very, very important and a very important value for us in our growth moving forward.
It's really interesting. And I would imagine, just listening to you talk through that, I would imagine that the past year with the pandemic has probably only reinforced your thinking there about sort of distributed workflow. And if you have a great candidate that lives somewhere, maybe, you know, maybe it doesn't, you don't have to have 400 people under one roof. Is IO sort of becoming more open to, you know, if there's a great, say, programmer in Canada, is that, you know, is that something that IO is starting to adapt as well? Is more teammates around the world?
Yeah, I mean, if there are some really, really gifted people around the world, we have some individuals who are working, you know, from different cities in Europe and whatnot, that we can work with. But I just want to say that it's true. We were both working with, you know, Sumo, and we were working with, you know, companies in Austria, and we opened the Malmö studio way before the pandemic started.
Right.
So we had some training in that. So I think in the start, when we had to kind of work from home, we were very effective. When that is said, over time, I would say like after the first 3-4 months, the cabin fever hits in, because although we are very flexible, it's still important to have that, like, the energy, you know, taking.
Absolutely.
Getting some energy, giving some energy, still being around people. The micro alignments are invaluable, and it's not only for, you know, managers. It's also important for developers, right? So we are seeing that, you know, the cabin fever is definitely kicking in. So I wouldn't say like our point is not to like have 500 people in 500 different homes around the globe, but have these certain size, the optimum size, as I believe and call it, location studios around the world, where they still can get together and still have a feeling of unity, having feeling of identity, and getting energy from each other, right? And so I think that's the main thing. So like, I guess with many other people, we are also looking forward to getting back into the office.
Yeah, I mean, I think we can all relate on the cabin fever. And even from a game development perspective, you know, you talk about the energy. I mean, how about when you're all trying to do a build review, which you do in the same room together, and everybody's watching the same thing and calling things out and taking notes? That's probably one of many, many things that, as someone who's not a game developer, I don't have full insight on. But there've got to be a million little things like that are difficult, if not impossible, to replicate in a remote scenario.
Yeah, I mean, build reviews depends on what phase you are in the production. Like Hitman, I mean, the team is absolutely amazing, and they're on their peak of their game when it comes to building Hitman, right? Like I was talking about this connected world between all three games, and it is actually a one executable. So when we introduced new features into Hitman 2 and 3 or visual upgrades, those have been retroactively fitted into Hitman 1 and 2 after, you know, with the latest improvements in Hitman 3. So it's kind of a one executable. And I think, like, the team has been absolutely fantastic. They've been developing and delivering Hitman in pandemic times. Right, we published that ourselves as well, and it came out on 10 platforms, and both on PlayStation 4 and PlayStation 5 and Xbox Series X versions, next-gen versions as well, on the Switch as well. So, and VR as well in pandemic time. So they've been really, really doing a great job. But also, that's also because it's almost like saying they know Kung Fu, they know Hitman, they know how to do that, right? And been training on that, on Journey for the last 8 years on that. It's a bit different on other areas, we feel like, while we still have, we are having like some of the incubation work, some of the, you know, very explorative R&D work, we do feel that there's, it's harder, like you need the small, pre-production team to be closer, and just try things out. Could you just up that with 3 points? How does it feel for them back? And it's difficult to kind of start a teams meeting around each small micro discussion there, right? So we feel the impact there, but Hitman was like a second nature, like another sixth sense for them.
Well, and the end result showed it. I mean, you guys, you know, this is why I love the story of you guys becoming independent and betting on yourselves, and now here we are, 2021. Hitman 3 is a, first let me talk about the critical success, 87 on Metacritic. I'm not sure if you really pay attention or care about that necessarily, but it is we have our own issues with what Metacritic is and isn't, as far as, you know, trying to boil everything down to one number, but that does, just in a, as a snapshot, it matches Hitman 2 Silent Assassin as the highest Metacritic rating the series has ever achieved. So I'm curious, during the course of Hitman 3, I mean, did you just, is there a point where you know that you've got a winner with this one? Because you mentioned 2016 and the reboot not getting off to the great start, and then Hitman 2 kind of moving back in the right direction. But did 3 really is just an absolute home run. So where, you know, did you know that it was, that you'd really nailed it?
Third time's the charm, I guess. I think you're always nervous, right? I mean, we had a really good feeling. We really felt the overarching story, the characters, you know, the closure that we were getting to with Hitman 3. We really felt that the characters were coming more front and center, and this conflict was more impactful to the player. One of the pillars for Hitman 3 was also intimacy, and I really feel that the team pulled that off perfectly. You know, it's also the first time Diana, she's in the game in one of the locations, and you get to play and do things together with her, right? So it was much more personal, much more intimate, and the story, I think, was more relevant and impactful to the gamers. So those things we did feel. I mean, one of the reviews, and this is, you know, this is true, it's no bullshit, sorry my language, but one of the reviews, I was literally getting, you know, getting emotional, and it was just the guys were like, hey, we have this build, and it's, you know, with Diana, and this is gonna happen, and I'm not as close to the production as I was. I'm having these monthly reviews, right? And one of them, they got these moments together, and I was literally moved. And that's where you feel it. You know, this is true. This is something. This feels genuine. And at that point, I think that was the pivotal point where I was like, okay, this is not only the level design, which just kept improving and getting better and better. Not only that, but emotionally connection, it's there. I can feel it, and I'm getting goosebumps when I talk about it right now. So at that moment, I got very confident I think everybody got more and more confident when those moments got together. But you never know, right? Like, I remember when we did Absolution. Absolution was a different Hitman experience, right? It was a more linear experience, and the game, the concept for that game when it came out, like when the pre-production was happening, it was like, you know, inspirations from Max Payne and games like that. But just because we were doing a new engine, like a new upgrade, major upgrade on the engine, it took way too long to do that game. And when it came out, it just felt like the open world or sandbox games were in again. And it felt just wrong or different, you know, for a lot of hardcore fans. I'm very proud of the game, but as a game, but I understand the fans were like, okay, you know, this is not the Hitman they wanted. And after that, we were like, you know, it had been, when we did Hitman 2016, it had been like 10 years where we haven't done like a classic Hitman sandbox level, right? And our fans were like, you know, do they still have the ability to do a Hitman game, right? Those were the kind of questions. And Blood Money was always like pulled, like mentioned, like, this is the best Hitman game. They're never going to top that. So yeah, with the episodic, there were some bumps on the road with the episodic model, but it was pretty clear from the get-go that the levels, you know, Paris, Sapienza, that there were something special. And, you know, I tend to say the Danish fairy tale story about Ogda Duckling and turning into a beautiful swan, that journey we already had alone with Hitman 1 during the episodes, right? So, you know, and just perfecting that over the years, I think that's been...
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/realm.
Anna Sheridan, missing for nearly 6 months now.
I need you to find me.
The Sheridans, a serialized horror mystery podcast. Stream the complete series today on Realm and on all podcasting platforms.
Pretty amazing.
Well, and I love, too, that you, on the commercial success side, you talk about how at one point you had 3 months of runway left and that Hitman 2016 didn't do nearly as well as you'd hoped, and that, you know, you're the models of, oh, you know, doing 80% of your business since the first 6 months are kind of changing. But then we come to Hitman 3, which, as I said, critical success. And then commercially, you come out and announce that Hitman 3 is profitable in a week. So, one, do you throw some sort of virtual party for the team at that to celebrate that moment? And did that exceed your expectations? I mean, I would imagine so, but I'm sort of curious, like, was that a big surprise that it was that commercially successful that quickly?
It was. I can honestly say that. It was, you know, above our sales budgets planned. Like Hitman 1, it took 4 years for it to recoup all its costs, right? Wow. And shorter with Hitman 2. But Hitman 3, definitely, like historically, we've never released a game that recouped our costs that quickly. And it just, it's a kind of a double impact on the, pat yourself on the shoulder factor, right? With the team doing an amazing game, and this is Hitman 3 we are publishing ourselves, and as a publisher also to do better than what Hitman 1 and Hitman 2 did with other publishers, right? So we are extremely proud, and I think the right word is extremely grateful. And to your point, whether Metacritic means something, I agree. It's difficult to kind of cook those things down to a number, whether you're looking at OpenCritic or Metacritic, whatnot. But it does mean, because that means something, right? That is what we have, and like from a professional pride, it means a lot. And when we had a huge studio meeting in Teams, right? The whole studio was locked onto Teams. And when the embargo was lifted, we refreshed the OpenCritic and Metacritic sites. And they were just starting to trickle in, like kind of a catch-up effect, right? Or like, if you had a low one, you're waiting for, higher ones are going to come and whatnot, right? And when it was in the high spot, you were like, I hope it's not going to drop, kind of thing, right? So it was amazing. And that meeting, like this is when we launched, before we launched, before 20th January, that meeting is still active. So it's called in Teams, it's called pre-launch, Metacritic meeting kind of thing, right? It's called that. And that is still ongoing, where people are still posting things, when we do a roadmap and there's another article or some community fun things and whatnot. So they're still posting things there, and it's still active. Like it's still, as I speak to you now, things are popping up in Teams, right? So that's pretty amazing. And of course, we're looking forward to having a fantastic party when we get together at one point when, hopefully when the world turns a bit more normal again. But until then, we kind of have a window into each other through this to this meeting that just keeps going and makes us really happy. So, again, grateful, absolutely grateful, absolutely smashing, fantastic, and commercially keeps going well. And apart from this game itself being success, it does tons for IO. Right, we took a great risk. It would have been the easiest thing in the world to get a partner after Hitman 2, that we proved that we can do fantastic game, keeping the consistency, the quality, and the momentum and the strength and the stability we had. It would have been the easiest thing to get a partner for Hitman 3. But again, just like when we went independent, who dares wins. We went for it. We took some big risks, even with pandemic times, and said, we're gonna spend our money, our cash flow, and going for it, and that's because we did believe that we know Hitman best, and we know our community, our gamers, our fans best, and we just wanted to both create and give this game to our fans directly, unplugged, unfiltered, and it turns out it was a good thing.
Well, yeah, you bet on yourselves and you reap the well-deserved rewards. I love the story of IO and this game specifically. Now, kind of, you mentioned the release date. It came out in late January there. In hindsight, you could have never planned for it, but do you feel like you kind of lucked out in a sense with, again, not to take anything away from the quality of the game, the success of the game, but do you feel like you kind of lucked out with the release date, as, Hitman 3 is really the first big game of 2021 after two, I would say, pretty quiet next-gen console launches overall. I feel like you guys were in a great spot of people were just wanting a new high-quality AAA experience, and you provided that in a time when there really wasn't too much else.
Absolutely. I mean, I keep saying from the get-go, our success is a mixture of skill. I think we have that. Something about timing, like agility, and the last thing is luck. There's always a factor of luck in this business as well, right? So you bet on something and it doesn't turn out like that, or something happens and turns out like that. I think one thing that we were very adamant with was that, like, Hitman has a very, very core and loyal fan base. But it's not necessarily like everybody's cup of tea, right? It's not like, it's maybe not approachable like Call of Duty, for example, a game like that would be, right? Because it's still unique. It's still different. You know, it's not like the best way of playing Hitman is not necessarily just pulling out your gun and shooting way through, right? Yeah. So
stealth games have never necessarily been super mainstream, right? So
yeah. So and I've always throughout, you know, as we talked about before, I've been with IO almost 15 years, and over the years I've always been like, you know, okay, we spent these crazy amount of marketing money in a window where, you know, classical box products around Christmas or around March, you know, these fiscal year times, there's a lot of titles coming out in those periods. And Hitman, you know, came out in those windows. Like Hitman Absolution came out in November. Hitman 2016 was out in March. And Hitman 2 came out in November as well, 18. And I was, for the longest time, like betting on, I think January is a great month, like, for these big games. I think Hitman is great big as well, but this slugfest around Christmas and March, like, I think there's a very great window for Hitman to come out in January. And, you know, it just panned out really well with new consoles, and, you know, that we actually could in time make a really good PlayStation, you know, next gen versions as well for that. So obviously that helped us as well. So I think there's a lot of, as they say in Jerry Maguire, that old movie, there's a quorn moment. A lot of things kind of got together, and it just fit and was perfect timing. So yeah, I mean, a part of it was planning. A part of it was some luck, I would say. And you know, we are here today and performing more than 200%. Compared to what Hitman 1 and 2 was doing in this period. So that's fantastic.
You know, we talked about stealth games there just in general for a second. This makes me want to ask you, you know, you're in control of your own destiny. IO is an independent studio. When you see that Metal Gear Solid is effectively dead, at least for the time being, Splinter Cell hasn't been seen in a long, long time. Thief hasn't been seen in a long, long time. Hitman's kind of it for like a big budget AAA caliber stealth game. Is that a good thing for you guys? Or is that like, do you wish that there were some other, you know, rising tide lifts all boats in the stealth genre? I'm sort of curious how you feel about that.
Well, I mean, I think I know a lot of people are saying Hitman is a stealth game, and it definitely can be played, you know, suit only, or, you know, in a stealth way. However, I find Hitman to be something else. Like, it's more like a, how do you call it? I think it's almost like Sims on steroids. It's more like a role playing, right? Like, it's stealth in another way. I mean, disguise is a perfectly viable way of traversal in Hitman and getting into places that you otherwise wouldn't. It's not like you have to like spin the cell, go into vents and crawl into corridors and whatnot, right, to get in there. You can just like just walk straight in there if you have the Sheik's outfit or whatever police outfit or whatnot, right? So I think there's definitely stealth in there, but I think it's like as an action adventure puzzle game, role playing game in yeah. some ways. I think Hitman is a bit different, and I would like to say special like that. It's a different offer and experience than those classical stealth games. So I think besides this disguise gameplay and this simulation of life in these sandboxes and locations that we create, I think we are also thinking more broadly about the Asian fantasy. Of course, in context with 007 now as well. So I think we identify ourselves as, you know, on that part of the creations we do as you know, we, you know, I think we pretty much own the Asian fantasy in gaming right now, and I think that's what we want to identify ourselves with first and foremost. But sure, there's of course a very viable way of playing stealth gameplay in Hitman if that's the way you wanna play the game.
So the next question I had for you, I'm now wondering if I should change, because you sort of touched on this a little bit while ago when you were talking about the structure of the studio and the future of the studio with in fact three IPs, three projects. So I was going to ask you, is it fair to say that Hitman 3 is the last new Hitman game for the foreseeable future, given that A, this was a trilogy, and B, you have 007 now? But it sounds like is Hitman going to continue on with the growth of the studio?
Yeah, so I think our thinking right now is that Agent 47 deserves a bit of a rest. Like he's been busy the last three games. But I think when that is said, you know, we are incredibly busy with the live beats, live elements, supporting the World of Assassination, as we call all three games. You know, for almost 5 years now, we've been releasing something new every week to our communities ever since we launched Hitman 1, and we'll keep doing that moving forward. And I believe there will be, you know, this is not the end of Agent 47. I just want to make sure that everybody knows that, like, Hitman is an absolutely, you know, as we talked about before, it's also synonymous with IO. It's a very beloved franchise of ours, and of course, Hitman will continue, and Agent 47 maybe is going to take a bit of a rest, but that doesn't mean that we're not working on some cool stuff within the World of Assassination. So there's definitely activity coming, and I'm looking forward to talk about that sometime in the future.
I do want to ask you a little bit about James Bond in a minute, but while we're still on the subject of Hitman, what was your reaction when you saw the first Hitman movie for the first time?
Honestly, it wasn't as bad as the second one when I saw that. But I think the first one,
it's kind of cool seeing it up on screen, right? That part's got to be great.
Absolutely. I think the first one was all right. Like, it wasn't like we would probably have done it in different way. Like, we have contact, right? We've been in contact with the producer, and there were, you know, a few meetings where we were giving some feedback and giving insights into Agent 47's background and the universe and whatnot. You know, it's always cool. There's like, we're grateful. It's cool. There's, you know, our IPs, characters that we create can transcend into other media, and that there are like two Hollywood movies. That's absolutely great. And I think that I personally think the first one was interesting. But I think if we were to do it, we would have done it a bit differently. We would have done it, you know, less shooting, dual baller shooting in the midst of the streets. So it would have been more close to, I think, what we were doing with the trilogy here that we just did.
I want to go back to your earlier days at IO for a second before we fast forward to 007. Kanan Lynch, what was it about that series you think that just, it seemed like it didn't quite break through the way Hitman did and become kind of a long-term thing?
I mean, one thing you can't say about IO is that you know, that we are not courageous with trying out some things that other studios maybe wouldn't. Yeah. Like I think back then, you know, the YouTube documentary kind of style. I also believe that it got recognized for the art direction in it, and you know, just creating these different characters, this quirky characters, like middle aged. With a dad body like myself here and bold guys, you know, it's I think it was like from art and from a creative perspective, I think it was very, very interesting. Obviously, it did the first one. I think didn't do. It was all right, but it didn't like, there were some issues with some of the technical aspects as well. Like I remember things like going cover and whatnot. And when we did the second one, we went even more into, you know, the art and the expression. And I think maybe looking hindsight, I think a few too many compromises were made on the feature side. I think it could have had more variation in the gameplay. I was working on the multiplayer part on that.
And, which I remember being really unique, wasn't it? Didn't you,
super
unique mode, right?
Well, you see a lot of you know, what you call PvP, PvE modes popping up here and there in different games. And I guess that was one of the first PvP, PvE games, multiplayer games created back then, because you know, it was pretty much about being this, these gangsters, thieves, and you were doing these heists and, you know, robbing banks and whatnot. And it was called Fragile Alliance for a reason, because that was kind of the core part of the gameplay, that at any point you could escape, you could shoot your way through the cops and security and escape with a getaway car altogether, or you could go for an individual win and shoot the other ones in the back and get their money and get away. But when you shot the other ones, they would respawn as police cops, and they would have a chance to revenge themselves, right? So the multiplayer was really, really interesting. However, back in the days, we weren't thinking like service, right? It was a very boxed product. The campaign was the main thing. And, you know, honestly, I think it was a fantastic, creative game. I'm especially proud of Kinglands 2, but it didn't do commercially well. And then the multiplayer was discontinued. Actually, when we changed our mentality, was Hitman Absolution, when we introduced something called Contracts. That was a game mode where you could, after completing the game, you could go back to these different locations and create your own targets and kill them in certain ways. And that would turn into a contract that you could send to another one and challenge your friends, you know, other people challenge your friends. And we thought, well, that would give more longevity and it's fun, right? We were just playing around with those tools ourselves. We thought it was fun, so we made it a mode in the game. And then more than a year after, there were still 60,000 daily users playing Contracts on Hitman Absolution. And we were like, what's happening here? How come this is a single player game, right? What is this? And that was actually the start of our thinking about an expanding universe for Hitman 2016, right? So it's been 8 years coming, you know, 8-9 years almost that we started development, and we changed mentality. I literally myself stood in front of the studio and was saying, like, from now on, it's going to be first kiss, everlasting love with the community. It's going to be a growing experience over time. And I believe what we created with the World of Assassination is, you know, what we call a single player as a service. I think we created something new in the industry.
Yeah, sure seems like it. And it's been working. I found something here. Either I'd love for you to explain this or refute it. Were you working on a game for Microsoft around 2010 that you know, didn't end up seeing the light of day?
Yeah, there was something, I think I was talking about that earlier. At one point we had like four AAA games and several engines under the same roof. And there were some activity and a project working with Microsoft, but I wasn't on the project. I was a bit, you know, further away from that. I was working on multiplayer stuff. This was just before I transitioned to Absolution and took over as a lead producer on that. So yeah, but there were definitely some collaboration going on with Microsoft, and it took another form and turned into something else, as far as I remember.
So, all right, Bond, because I gotta let you go here pretty soon. I don't want to keep you here all day, all night. Put me in the room with you for that James Bond deal. What was your pitch to MGM? I mean, obviously you can't get into like gameplay specifics at this point, but I read that the team spent 2 years building a 007 pitch. So, what was the process like with pitching MGM, the license holder?
I mean, the pitch did not take 2 years. I think the pitch itself maybe took, less than a month. But the whole process took a long time, you know. And the process, you know, it starts with our partners at Delphi, meeting them and talking about opportunities. And, from that to first contact with MGM, and second contact with MGM, and then meeting the people at Eon in London. So the whole process from the first meeting till a signature and starting pre-production, it took almost 2 years. It was very special. I mean, it hasn't been a Bond game for a while, and I think it's no secret that the people at Eon were maybe waiting for the right opportunity, maybe for the right timing, and maybe for the right people to do another Bond game. And we knew it would be very difficult, but we didn't. I think we had a very humble approach. We were like trying to convey, who we are and why we think we could do a good Bond game. And there were times where you could be cheeky and say, like, it felt like, and it truly felt like that we've been training for this for 20 years doing Hitman, right? And as I said before, it's stealth game is one thing, but it's really an agent fantasy. And many things that you can do in Hitman, where it's not just about shooting the first opposition right away, like people are not shooting just when they see you. You can actually mingle amongst these your targets and stuff like that. It's not only the agent fantasy, but it's also the tech and the game design and our competences. I think there were very natural to creating a Bond experience that is close to what Eon likes to create in their movies. For example, classical scenes like Bond going into a casino and just sitting right in front of the villain and having a conversation, right? And and takes the person down later. That it's you can do those things in cutscenes in mini games or other developers, but we can do that in game. We can make you feel like Bond in those situations in game. And so I think the last 20 years and seems also like the universe kind of was saying that IO might be a good developer for Bond, because we were seeing all these different articles popping up saying like Hitman is the closest thing to a Bond fantasy in gaming, with those things and with presenting something where we would say like where we believe we could make you feel like Bond, playing the story, playing the game, and feel like Bond. I think those things were spot on. And also, I think we've been dabbing our feet in. We have done things like Ken Lynch and whatnot, but I think all those years we've also been trying to be different, but also owning a few things, like for example owning cool, as we called it, like the agent fantasy on being cool. I think this suaviness or the charm of 007, and you know, creating these locations. He's a globetrotter as well, right? So
yeah.
Creating these locations and this coolness, I think, is something that we have a good eye for. So yeah, I mean, it was an absolutely fantastic feeling, and it was nerve-wracking to meet Ian, the family in London. You know, the air is filled with tradition and history, and you know, but it just, you know, we try to be humble and we try to convey what we were dreaming of and what we wanted to do, and do something that both we would be proud of and hopefully they would be proud of. And it seems like they convinced them.
Is there a specific designer or developer on the team that initially sort of, like, I'm just, where was the initial germ of the idea of, like, we should try to do a 007 game?
Well, I mean, we've been throwing it around just in fun and whatnot over the years, right? It would be cool. And you know, we were also like smiling a bit when we were seeing these articles, as I mentioned before, like I don't know, should do a Bond game and whatnot, right? So I think when it really like started to dawn on us is when and here I must give credit to our partners at Delphi as well, is when they were like, you know, why not? You know, you guys are, it makes sense when people are saying that IO is the right company to do a really, really good Bond game. And we were like, all this time, you know, we are smiling, and it was warming our hearts when people are saying that, you know, we could do a good Bond game. And we were like, yeah, why not? Let's go for it. And you know, from that point on, my partner, Christian Elverdam, which is the chief creative officer, he, you know, it just felt like, again, it sounds so cheesy to say, but it just felt like we've been training for this for 20 years, right? It just felt so natural to formulate, to articulate what is it, what is style, what is coolness, and what does Bond do, and what wouldn't he do? You know, and you know, we got some new people on the team as well, who are absolutely fantastic from a story pitch point of view, and from, you know, also from really understanding the British heritage and the history for the Bond IP. And you know, we have a great team. I think again, this is a case of, like, it's been maybe brewing for some time unknowingly, but it's a case of, it's the right timing, it's the right moment, and it's the right people that are here in the studio today, both old veterans and new, that came together and this happened.
Well, you alluded to Casino Royale, but you've also said that you won't be featuring like an actor or likeness that we've seen on film before in your games. Are you guys taking inspiration from the movies, from the books, or a mix of the two?
Well, important to mention, like, this is new for us. I mean, doing a licensed game is new to us. We've only done our own original IPs, right? We created these characters and worlds ourselves from scratch. So I think for us to really embrace this fully and really, as I said before, we don't like to work mechanical. You know, it's not just because it's a big IP or it's a licensed game and you know, commercially this is interesting or not. It means nothing to us. We've taken a lot of risks, non-commercial risk before, and so for us it's about we need to feel it deep inside. The passion needs to be there. So it was very important for us that it wasn't a movie adaptation. So it wasn't a game about, you know, with Daniel Craig or with a specific movie where the story has already been told. It's very important that we could create a digital Bond, a Bond for the gaming industry. And that's very unique, right? And a becoming story to that. So it's a complete original story. So this felt really, really important for us. And we conveyed that to Ion, and you know, they agreed that the result would probably be better doing like that. So I think you know, there's always excitement around a new Bond. You know, it's amazing what they have done with their franchise over the years. Every Bond kind of defines a generation, and it's amazing how they kept reinventing themselves over so many years. So it's not, we're not only inspired by one movie or games and whatnot. We're inspired by the whole thing, and just sucking things into us to make an original Bond, an original story, but that is absolutely true and recognizable in the values there is in Bond. So yeah, I'm really looking forward to creating a new you know, community that is, that the gamers can call their own. So it's not like a movie community, but it's also a gaming community starting from scratch and growing together with the game we're going to create.
Yeah. Now, if you put your CEO hat back on, does it concern you at all that MGM has put itself up for sale? Like, is there a situation where if Bond gets sold, MGM sells it, could a new owner come in and either kill your deal that you have, or maybe even worse, end up being like a meddling, horrible partner that won't leave you alone to do what you guys do best?
Well, I certainly don't hope so. Right. Of course. I mean, we don't have more insight to that part than you have.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't know, but certainly not. I hope that if they sell MGM, that whoever the new owner is going to be, hopefully they will see a great opportunity in this get together between IO Interactive and the Bond franchise, and hopefully they will also see that that this could be a very, very special special game. You know, if they get sold, a new owner comes in, hopefully we will have a really good relationship to them as well as we have with MGM today.
Question I have for you, I do want to bring up, you know, something that's been talked about a lot in recent years in the industry, and that's just the idea of crunch. I was really fascinated by your description of your new thinking about the studio and not having just 400 cogs in a machine under one roof, and sort of having these studios with their cultures and having everybody feel valued and a part of an important part of the process. How do you think about, as the, you know, co-owner, CEO of the studio, how do you think about crunch and the idea of trying to balance the needs of the project with the you know, the taking care of your team?
Yeah, I think I talked about that before at different interviews about crunch. Like Hitman, I mentioned that Hitman Absolution was on the way for a long time. So the whole production lasted 7 years, and that's why, you know, Max Payne was the really cool stuff. But the world kind of moved on while that game was trying to be made. And it was because of this major overhaul of the technology. Meanwhile, doing a game is, you know, cannot be recommended. And I came on after Ken and Lynch. I took over as a executive producer on that just 2 years before it was launched. And at that point, it was, you know, the technology was just barely done. It was nowhere there. Although it has been on the way for 5 years, it didn't really have any core features. Core features in place yet. That production was an absolutely, it was crazy. Like, I mean, for me personal, I ran people really hard. I was really hard. We crunched a lot. And I remember personally myself, in 2 years, I had 2 weekends where I was off both days, or else I would work every day for 2 years straight, no vacation. And, you know, I learned a ton from that. After that, you know, I went on to do R&D, and then I went on to be studio production director. When I turned to be the studio production director, I could actually affect things on how I would like run my productions, run the EPs, on the different projects. So I did learn a lot from that. I did learn it's not only, you know, destroying souls, but it's also not an effective way of delivering games. Now, I'm not saying we're not doing overwork. We do at times, but it's, you know, it's something that needs to be felt like a good, clear purpose from a team within the team. And it's it needs to be on a shorter amount of periods than these long crunch periods. I mean, we are measuring everything with something called Peacon anonymously, and we have done that for a long time, also before introducing this tool, Peacon. And we have a great feedback on work-life balance. I think we're doing some good things now. I think we learned a ton from our past. You know, while in every project-based work, there will be some times where we have to be more flexible in one way or the other, right? We are also not a company that is, you know, where you have a punch card and you need to meet at 8 or whatever, right? If you go to the dentist and whatnot, you are absolutely, nobody would ask you where you have been, right? So there's a lot of flexibility falling back. And I think people are, you know, at least the feedback we're getting is very positive and seems like we found a really, really good balance there. And we had to because, you know, also after Absolution, when we changed mentality and culture around being, you know, doing a marathon, doing a game that's going to be more of a marathon than just a sprint, right? Going from box product thinking to a service, it absolutely affects everything. It also affects the way you work, and you can't just say, well, it's just another you know, few months and then it's out. Then we don't have to think about it. The whole studio can go home for half a year or something. That doesn't go when you work and you run a marathon. So it was also about keeping our energy and keeping people's front lobes fresh, right? And of course, also very important as we get older and wiser, not to make people estranged from their loved ones and families at home. These things are extremely important. I think it's also part of the Scandinavian mentality. And as I talked about, you know, other studios, locations under IO in the future, that culture, that thinking, those values, with the humans in front and center, is something that will spread and carry on.
Ken Abrick, thank you so much. The CEO, co-owner of IO Interactive, many congratulations to you and your team on the well-deserved success of Hitman 3. We've got 007, possibly as a trilogy you've alluded to look forward to there, and sounds like maybe even a third project might be waiting in the wings as time goes on. Håkan, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you so much.
For more Bye-bye. From the best, brightest, and most interesting minds in the games industry, check back every month or so for a new episode of IGN Unfiltered.
Hello, friends. This is Mark Nell, executive producer of the Table Read podcast, where imagination meets performance. As we wrap up an incredible season one, we want to take a moment to express our heartfelt gratitude to each and every one of you who tuned in and supported us on this amazing journey. Season one was nothing short of extraordinary. We delved into captivating scripts that transported us to worlds beyond our imagination, thanks to the brilliant writers who delivered these works. But what really brought these stories to life were the talents of our amazing actors. But wait, the excitement doesn't end there. As we bid farewell to Season 1, we are thrilled to announce the launch of Season 2. Get ready for more gripping narratives, more unforgettable characters, and more mesmerizing performances that will keep you on the edge of your seat. We have some big surprises coming. The Force will definitely be with you. So stay tuned, stay engaged, and most importantly, stay excited. From all of us at the Table Read Podcast, thank you, and let's make Season 2 even more memorable together.